We are going to be talking about Exodus. If you want to look at, we will look at a couple of verses toward the end to try to add another amount of confusion to this matter of Egyptian chronologies. I think it's very, very interesting. The text that we're kind of using to begin with is Exodus 1:8, which says, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph." Exodus is set in this context of a change in the country of Egypt, and of course, the Exodus itself is a huge change in the country, in the land of Egypt. There's 10 plagues. There's a massive group of people that leave. And so there's great changes happening there also. And before I get any further in here, three weeks ago. Anyway, first week in February, I forgot to talk about our verse. It sounds like many of you did well on the verse. Next week is the last week already for the verse. And I've been working on it, and I did memorize it. You're just going to have to trust me on that. It's way shorter than January's verses. So me and my wife have been working on this one, and it is much easier. But next week, we will have a chance for everybody that has memorized it to say it, kind of like we did last month with saying it to a neighbor. And we'll see how many people actually say it perfectly or almost perfectly from memory. Luke 12:15, tremendous verse. I don't remember the lesson, but I just remember struck by this passage when we were teaching through Luke. It was a long, 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 long time ago. But a man had said, "Teacher, tell my brother to share his inheritance with me." And Jesus said, "Man, who am I to you?" And he said unto them, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth." And then he goes on to the rest. So anyway, be practicing the verse. We'll have an opportunity for everybody to say that next week. Anyway, so then back to Exodus. There are difficulties when we look at Exodus. There are difficulties lining up every place in the Bible where ages and times are mentioned. Egyptian chronology is confusing. Also, there's various versions of that, and this, what I'm given, is a simplified, oversimplified, perhaps. And there are other, I'll just say, there's other chronologies that make sense. In the process of time, I was studying this. I looked at a few sources. And then as you keep looking, since it took more than 1 week to get through it, I've run into some other sources that are very interesting. Let's just put it that way. And I'll mention those at the end. If this is the type of thing that interests you, you'll want to run out there and look at that stuff. Speaking of running out and looking at stuff, this is why I don't get through my lessons in time. You really ought to read Robinson Crusoe, and you ought to read the whole thing, the real whole thing, the unabridged Robinson Crusoe. You can get a very long, you can get like the mostly version of it. But the mostly version of it, like maybe 95% of it, the 5% that's not there is the part that you really, as a Christian, want to read. Because he just really lets his Christianity out there. Not that he doesn't let it out throughout the book. But even if you can get it, listen to it, make sure you get an unabridged version of it. If you're a digital reader, if you're a hands-on reader, there are hundreds of thousands of copies of it. You could get that very, very cheap. But anyway, and we might even be to the time where there's people sitting in here that learned about Robinson Crusoe in school here, because we've been teaching it, the whole thing, for a while. How many of you learned Robinson Crusoe in our classrooms here? Adam Case is up there raising his hand, and I think there's others. So anyway, okay, back to Exodus. Just very quickly, we talked about the 12th dynasty, and in this chronology, the 12th dynasty is when Abraham and Isaac and Jacob live. And then there's an intermediate period, and an intermediate period is where there's several kings at the same time, and a king or a family of kings, which is a dynasty going on at the same time. There's not a centralized kingdom type of thing. And during that time, we have things going on in Upper Egypt, which is in the south, and Lower Egypt, which is in the north, closer to the delta of the Nile River. And this is the time period of the 15th dynasty, which is also called the Hyksos dynasty. And we'll just point out that the Hyksos dynasty was not an Egyptian dynasty. They were foreigners. They were Amorites. And they came in and totally took over the land. There's different, you know, they appeared early, but at some point they took over. They were the kings of Egypt, and yet they were not Egyptians. It seems during this time that Jacob goes up to Haran. Joseph is born during this time. Jacob returns. Joseph is sold into Egypt this time. So Joseph is sold into Egypt during this time, and he's falsely accused and then raised to power. I'm just going quickly over this because we kind of talked through all this. Joseph dies in Egypt around 1590 in this chronology, and the Hyksos are driven out by the 17th dynasty in 1570. The 17th dynasty, though, the king of that dynasty dies in the battles, driving them out. And the 18th dynasty then begins with one of his leaders. Amos was the first king of that, and he had a son, Amenhotep, the first, and then his, I'm reviewing quickly, so I'm not being as careful with the details. He had a royal daughter, but not a royal son. So Thutmose the first married into the royal family, and he's a legitimate king because men sat on the throne, but royalty was passed along through the females. He had many successful campaigns. He also had no royal son, but he had a daughter who was royalty, and that is Hatshepsut. And we said that it's conceivable that she is the daughter of Pharaoh that recovered Moses from the river in Exodus 2. He had another son from a concubine or something like that, and he arranged that son, Thutmose II, would marry his royal daughter, Hatshepsut. And so then Thutmose II had a legitimate claim to the throne because of his royal wife. Hatshepsut is quite a person in Egyptian history. She is shrewd and powerful, and so she then is the actually shows up in the line of kings or pharaohs, even though we've said that, you know, it was men that sat on the throne. She helped to rule with her half-brother husband, Thutmose II, from 1518 to 1504. He was an unhealthy child. He had no royal sons. So like three generations with no royal sons, but a royal daughter. He had a daughter. He had a son from a harem girl or from a concubine or something, and his name was Thutmose III. And Thutmose II dies early. He dies while Thutmose III, his son, harem girl's son, is very, very young. He's not really old enough even to reign, and he's not a legitimate royal pharaoh. So I don't know how they worked this out, but Hatshepsut offers herself to be able to help this Thutmose. And, you know, so then she is actually ruling Egypt with this young child, you know, as she rules as regent, and the young child is the pharaoh. And then in the line of things, we see that Thutmose II with Hatshepsut, and then Hatshepsut with Thutmose III. She's the regent. First she's the wife, then she's the regent, and then it's Hatshepsut by herself. Thutmose III is gone from the picture. Now, he's not totally gone, and this becomes a problem for her and her dynasty. She sent Thutmose III off to work and lead in the military while he was very young, and she was more of a pacifist type of a leader. She diminished the status of the military, and in that way diminished the power and ability of this Thutmose III. She used diplomacy and commerce to promote her country, but then you can imagine that she was disliked and resented by the military. It seems like, if we're looking at the chronology right, in this chronology, Moses is about 30 years old when she takes full control of Egypt. And we'd see a reference to that in Acts 7, 22 and 25. Moses was learned in he was taught in all the learning and the greatness of Egypt, and even demonstrated ability there. Thutmose III doesn't just disappear, though. The army, the military, uses him, and he is actually very able, capable as a leader, and he increases his own power and becomes one of the greatest powers in Egyptian history. And about 1483, Hatshepsut dies. History doesn't tell us why or how she dies. She just dies. We don't know if it was an assassination or a poisoning she was way too young to die of old age, but she mysteriously dies. And it seems like probably about this time Moses makes contact with his Hebrew brethren. You remember when he did that? It seems like he was thinking perhaps that this would be a time to strike. He has a lot of power. He has a lot of influence. And maybe if he could use that to free, or at least to free the Hebrews from bondage. Maybe not necessarily to free them, you know, to take them out of Egypt, but to get them out from under bondage. But we know from reading the scriptures, and we'll get there in several weeks, how that turned out. And he has to flee Egypt. Thutmose III eliminates Hatshepsut from public life and memory. This is unsuccessful. She was very powerful. She builds this, I've seen pictures of this tremendous, like, burial ground vault, which is kind of a propaganda piece for all these things that tell about how great she was and how the gods delivered her to be, you know, whatever, all this type of thing. So you cannot, erase her from their history and memory, but he does as good a job as he can. And he expands the Egyptian control to the border of the Hittite Empire. So this is all the way up. I didn't put a map here, but Egypt, you know, is down lower. And see if I can get this the right way. Yeah. So then Egyptian control spreads over and up through Canaan and touches, borders the Hittites, who are coming down from Turkey. And this is actually, they border at a town of Kadesh, which ends up many years later being one of the cities of refuge. It's a northern city of refuge in the Canaanite side. So it's pretty far that he expands Egyptian control. He dies, and his son, Amenhotep II, becomes the pharaoh. He's young. He's athletic, he's ambitious, he's arrogant, and all these things match our view of the Pharaoh of the Exodus. He has some early aggressive military campaigns. He takes over, he receives the throne in 1450. In this chronology, the Exodus takes place in 1446, 1445, 46, 47, somewhere in there. And, of course, this is B.C. dates. So about 5 years into his reign, this 80-year-old man shows up on his porch and says, "Let my people go," and we'll get into the things that happen there. And that kind of changes things for him for quite a lot in a tremendous way. Something that we should note, though, is Amenhotep the second's dates are from 1450 to 1419. That means he reigned over Egypt for 30 years. He reigned over Egypt for 30 years, and he was quite a successful pharaoh, at least the way the Egyptian history books are written. So that takes us through Exodus, through Exodus, and the kings. I want to just mention a few other things. One of the reasons that Egyptian chronology is important is because it is the chronology in almost all cases that everybody else's dates are tied to. In Egypt, since it's dry, they write their histories on walls, you know, 20-foot walls, 30-foot walls, and it's this hieroglyphics that, you know, now we know how, now people know, not me, how to read it. And it's just there, and it's in the desert. It hasn't been destroyed. I mean, there's chips taken out here and there, but there's a tremendous amount of history written in the desert that has not been lost to the elements of nature and time. So, and there's references to all these other places. There's references to Persia and to Greece and to Canaan and all these other places. And those references are in this line of history that is in Egypt. So even though we might think, well, it's just Egypt, because of that, in an academic way, archaeological way, it's all there, and it's in an order, even though we can say, well, they didn't say this or that, the order is there, and it's there preserved for a millennium. So that's why this Egyptian history is kind of important. Let me just tell you, let's look at three references that I think are very influential in this, and this is where we're just going to add some confusion to the matter. The first one, a very important one, which I kind of mentioned, 1 Kings 6:1, and I'm 1 Kings 6:1. Says in 1 Kings 6:1, and it came to pass in the 404 year after the children of Israel will come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month Ziph, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. So this is very, just again, this is an academic statement in the scriptures, but it says it's pretty straightforward. 480 years to this point, 4 years into the reign of Solomon, in this month. 480 years previous is when the children of Israel came out of Egypt. This is where, in a conservative dating time, we come up with the date of 1446. That's where that date comes from. Here's another important date reference in the Bible, and this is 1 Kings 14:25. And this is important, but it also introduces a little bit of a conundrum, a little bit of, huh. So, 1 Kings 14, make sure I've got the right number, 1425, yes. And it came to pass in the fifth year of King Rehoboam that Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He even took away all the shields of gold which Solomon had made. Okay, so here we have a date where there's a king of Egypt who comes to Israel, and he takes gold out of the temple, and takes these shields away and all of these types of things. And his name is Shishak. Now, if we look in Egyptian kings' history, there's one called Shishank. And it seems obvious, it seems plausible that Shishank and Shishak, probably the same guy. So, and it's funny, I'm saying it that way, academia says he is the same guy. And so, I don't know, 120 years ago, this guy said, I found Shishank, he's Shishak, he has something in there in his history about raiding Israel, and so he is Shishak here. So, while Egyptian chronology is like the gold standard, all of a sudden this Bible reference here has told Egyptian chronology where to be, you know, where the dates are. If we look at that date and we look at Egyptian chronology, Egyptian chronology then tells us that the Exodus took place in 1215. Well, that's a problem because we have this other 480 years, and that tells us that Ramses the second is the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Everybody knows him. What's his name? Yul Brynner, yes. Yul Brynner, Ramses the second. And so since that's true, then we look for the evidence of the conquest. We have cities that were empty and not occupied that were conquered by Joshua, and therefore the Bible can't be true because it's telling these myths. It's something that just came about. It's an accumulated history of stories that is the background for this strange people in history, the Israelites. Okay, so the passage about Shishak in Kings is problematic. It makes the Pharaoh of the Exodus Ramses. There are many problems with that in the timing, even in the historical and archaeological evidence. But linguistic studies have found that there's another person that could be Shishak. Actually, Ramses II has many names, as kings would, and one of his names would be Shishah. Could Shishah and Shishak be the same person? Seems like they could be. And so if that's the case, then if Ramses II is actually the king that fought against Rehoboam, then it allows for all kinds of patterns that are seen in the Exodus, in the archaeology of Egypt, that fit the Bible to be in a proper place. Here's, to me, a key verse that says, let's look at this a little bit more, is in Deuteronomy, and we'll stop with this one. Deuteronomy 11, verse 4. It's interesting. After the first time of this, Mr. Ed Kriegel, I think it was one of the Kriegels. There was a Kriegel son and another Kriegel son and a Kriegel father. It might have been all three generations, might have been two, mentioned something to me about this idea. And I thought, okay, I don't have time to study that. I'm just going to just keep going with what I've got. It fits in with my introduction. There's a lot of different chronologies. But then as I'm going along, I'm reading some other stuff and watching some lectures, and these lectures are saying certain thing, and I come to this fairly solid conclusion, and I realize that it's the same thing that they had said. So I found this out independently, even though I was already told about it, if that makes sense. But after that, I read this verse. Moses is talking to the second generation of Israelites. They are getting ready to enter the land. If we follow the timing, they've been in the wilderness. They're in the 10th month, I believe, in the 10th month of the 40th year of wilderness wanderings. And in Deuteronomy 11, verse 4, it's a long sentence, so we'll just take it there. And what he did unto the army of Egypt. So Moses is telling the Israelites about what God did to the army of Egypt, unto their horses and to their chariots, how he made the water of the Red Sea to overflow them as they pursued after you, and how the Lord has destroyed them. What are the next three words? Unto this day. So I noted that Amenhotep II was a ruler for 25 years after the Exodus. That doesn't seem to match this phrase, unto this day. So that's the confusion I've added. The alternate timeline with Ramses being the king that fought against Jeroboam puts all of this that we've talked about in the wind. And it makes it so that the Hyksos, these non-Egyptians that destroyed the land of Egypt, they did so against a land of Egypt that had been destroyed already, that didn't have an army, and they ruled for hundreds of years. And it might be, it seems, evidence points like it could be, that the Hyksos actually started their reign somewhere around 1440, 1447, 1440, you know, right after, or 1443, after the timing of the Exodus. So, sorry about the confusion. If you're interested in these things, I would just point you to a website and a man's name. The website would be Patterns of Evidence, patternsofevidence.com. I've seen two of his videos that are very, very interesting, very true to the Bible. And then if you look for any lectures by a man by the name of David Rohl, R-O-H-L. David Rohl, he studies the third intermediate period of Egypt, which is the time of lots of confusion, and it's the time of Rehoboam and all that. And David Rohl is actually an agnostic, but he's willing to look at the Bible as a history book, as something that should be treated like every other history book. And he tends to be, in his agnostic mind, the Bible stands up to history, which is interesting for an agnostic to say that. It's not interesting at all for us. We would say that, of course, the Bible stands up to history. So some thoughts, and next week we'll actually get to Exodus 1:1 and move on from there. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word and ask that